Today's Teisho will be on case 60 in the Pien Lu, the Blue Rock Collection. Case 60 is entitled Umon's Staff Becoming a Dragon. Engo's Introduction. Buddhas and sentient beings are not by nature different. Mountains, rivers, and your own self are all just the same. Why should they be separate and constitute two worlds? Even if you are well versed in Zen koans and know how to deal with them, if you stop there, everything is spoiled. If you do not stop, the whole world will be dissolved, with not a particle of it left behind. Now tell me, what does it mean to be well-versed in Zen koans? See the following. Umon held out his staff and said to the assembled monks, "The staff has transformed itself into a dragon and swallowed up the whole universe. Where are the mountains, the rivers, and the great world?" Secho's verse. The staff has swallowed up the universe. Don't say peach blossoms float on the water. The fish that gets its tail singed may fail to grasp the mist and clouds. The ones that lie with gills exposed need not lose heart. My verse is done, but do you really hear me? Only be carefree. Stand unwavering. Why so bewildered? 72 blows are not enough. I want to give you 150. Thank you very much for coming to practice on this beautiful summer day. It was so nice to leave this room after our zazen and go outside. Perhaps you noticed that, you know, when we did that, your minds may have been as clear and empty as that blue sky. You know, normally, our minds are not necessarily clear and empty. You know, when we go outside after we're leaving work, maybe you have to walk to your car and you get to walk through some trees and some plants like the ones we walked around this morning. Your mind is mostly focused on issues at work. And as you're walking, you're just making sure you don't bump into something. You might not notice the trees around you or the insects on the flowers. And when you get in your car, you're driving home thinking all the time about something at work. This is so characteristic of our ordinary everyday consciousness. But, you know, when we practice Zazen, it happens that we learn how to become blank-minded. And that means that when we're looking at things, you know, our minds are as blank as that blue sky. In fact, blue sky in Zen texts, Lan Tian, often a symbol of the unobstructed mind. Lan Tian. Blue sky. You'll see it all the time, even in the koan collections. There'll be a reference to blue sky, and if you don't do zazen, you'll just think that's some colorful language. But in fact, the koans are loaded with those kinds of references that only somebody who's practiced deeply will understand. So, you know, we left the Zendo this morning. Some of us came here very early, and some of us came here a little later. And after an hour of really determined sitting, and we go outside, and, you know, mind is in a very different place. You know, the tempo of your consciousness has slowed down. you know, that feeling that you have to move is perhaps diminished. So there's a more natural pacing to your awareness. And as you're walking around with the mind that's empty or emptier, right, you can feel the heat. You know, you can hear the birds, the wind. You can see the wind moving through the plants. It's really quite a different world. It's a great pity more people don't understand this experience. You know, being empty-minded is not to be stupid. You know, in the English language, we have an expression, empty-headed. He says, empty-headed. You know, that person is empty-headed. Generally speaking, people aren't empty-headed. You know, that's the problem, actually. It's very difficult to have an encounter with the moment in which you don't bring your baggage. All day long, you know, much of our time is taken up with that busy, chattering mind. So it's really so wonderful to just sit down on the cushion for an hour and then go outside and experience the world in this completely different way. You know, if you have been doing a lot of sitting, when you go outside like that, you realize, you know, in a certain sense, time is still there. You know, we're moving, and I myself was watching the clock. You know, I didn't want our keenheen to go on too long, and I didn't want it to be too short. So, you know, periodically I'll look down to see where we are. But in another sense, you know, when your mind is blank like that, you know, you sometimes feel that the moment itself is really timeless. It's timeless. You know, I'm sure you've experienced those timeless moments before. You know, you probably remember some of them from your childhood, moments where, you know, you went to the pool and with your family, and after swimming in the pool, you were all sitting at the table, and your mother opened up something for you to drink. And you look around, and you're just so happy to be with these people you love on such a beautiful day. And now, maybe 10 years, 20 years, 30 years later, you know, that moment is still there. And when you focus on it, it's so alive. You know, you had millions of moments in your life that you don't recall. Why do you recall that one? This is very interesting, right? You know, sometimes there's moments in our lives that we remember, they stay with us. Why do they stay with us anyway? Sometimes they're frightening moments, that's definitely so. But the moments that are happier moments that stay with us, I think, are these moments where, without knowing it, we entered a thoughtless state. The mind was at rest. The busy mind was quiet. And we became one with our surroundings. And I think we remember those moments because they're so remarkable. It's the moments when we're really, I would say, most alive. Right? When the busy, chattering mind is silent, and now we're one with everything around us. So this was a lovely, lovely opportunity this morning to go out and practice this empty-minded perception of the world, which is takes a lot of energy to get there. You know, we don't really know if animals have that experience or not. You know. In Zen tradition, we tend to think that animals do have that kind of perception. As you know, if you've been practicing Zen for a while, we all call mu. At some point, it will be your fate or your karma to come into the Dokusan room at Sesshin and have to call mu. I hope you, if you haven't done it yet, I hope with my whole heart that you will. When you call Mu, it's going to be so hard to do because it's going to feel so contrived, right? You're going to be, when you realize in the evening that it's time to come in to see me in Dokusan, you're going to be seized with anxiety. You're going to say, what am I going to do? I have to call Mu. And then, you know, when you come into the Dokusan room and I'll say, would you like to call Mu? Which is kind of a rhetorical question. I'm really saying, please call Mu. It's so difficult to be in that blue sky mind, right? Because we want to pass the koan, we don't want to be foolish. But sometimes it becomes possible to act from that place. The mind is just blank and you call Mu and you're not concerned about the results, you know. And all kinds of wonderful things can happen. So, today's koan is entitled Umon's Staff. Umon held out Umon, this is Master Yunmen, Cloud Gate, held out his staff and said to the assembled monks, this staff has transformed itself into a dragon and swallowed up the universe. Where are the mountains, the rivers, and the great world? So that's such a wonderful, wonderful koan. Our society definitely works very, you know, we think in the West, we people in the West believe that freedom comes from getting to define our own selves, getting to be fully our own selves. And if you go to the remaining bookstores, like a Barnes & Noble bookstore on Route 22 that I sometimes go to, which I very much enjoy having a cup of tea and reading a magazine for free, I really like that store, and they have a big section entitled Self-Help. And it's a very large section of books, and it's very typical of our culture that we would have such a large section entitled Self-Help, because, you know, we Westerners believe that freedom comes from having a self, or we might say expressing yourself freely. Now, I actually believe this is true to some in some ways, right? So, it's complicated, though, because we tend to think that when we're expressing ourselves, we're behaving naturally. When I was about 5 years old, when the Beatles came to, maybe I was a little older. The Beatles, most of you probably know who the Beatles are, I'm hoping, you know. But the Beatles, this very famous rock group, I probably should say, came from Great Britain to the United States. And they were an instant hit in the 1960s because we had nothing like their music. And it was a time where everybody was expected to be fit in. Everybody was expected to sort of like fit the social role that they were assigned to. If you've ever seen the program Mad Men, it was a little bit like the program Mad Men, where, you know, my father used to wear a white suit and a tie, and he would go off every day to work with a briefcase, and he would, he would go off. It would be like, we were living at that time in the D.C. area, and like 4 million men would get up and put on their white shirts and their tie and either drive or catch the train into D.C. with their briefcases. And if it was raining, they all wore a London Fog raincoat. And that was it, you know. And they all came home at about the same time. And of course, that's so dumb, right? So 4 million people go in and 4 million people come out. And of course, there's a massive traffic jam every day, right? But that's how it was, you know. So, and my father, when he came home, you know, he had his white shirt. Now it was all rumpled and his tie was off. Next day, fresh white shirt, new tie, off to work. And it was like that in school too. You know, we didn't have uniforms in school, but there was sort of a uniform. You usually wore a pair of slacks, and if not a white shirt, some kind of a button-down shirt. And suddenly the Beatles came, and the Beatles were like an explosion in our culture, because they didn't dress like that. You know, they had a different, if you've ever seen pictures from the 60s, the Beatles had their own weird clothing style. So they had jackets that didn't have any collars. They looked a little bit like Nehru jackets. And they had trousers, but the trousers stopped at their ankles, and they wore shoes with very, very, very pointed toes. And their haircuts were all the same. And it looks like somebody had put a bowl over their head and just cut around the lip of the bowl, right? And they sang this music that was like nothing on the radio. You know, when I was a little kid, my parents would listen to Frank Sinatra on the radio in the car. I was, even then, I wanted to throw myself out the window, you know? As I've gotten older, I've developed a taste. I see why people like Frank Sinatra, right? But my parents, who were from the New York area, loved Frank Sinatra, you know? So when the Beatles came, it was just wonderful. And when they sang, they did crazy things. They shook their heads and their hair went flying, and they made these, you know, incoherent noises. It was so liberating. You know, it was like, you can do that, you know? And actually, many people thought you couldn't do that. They were very upset about the Beatles, you know? Some authorities in our culture were very worried. The Beatles are a threat to our culture, you know? Their pants are too tight. Their shoes are pointy. People got very upset. There were even public breakings of their records. You know, these are the devil's records. You know, it was like, so, the Beatles were so liberating. I was a little too young to really experience it, but some of my cousins and my wife's older sister, it was just like the sound of freedom, you know. And they were on Ed Sullivan, and the Ed Sullivan Show, I think that was the most viewers that the Ed Sullivan Show ever had. It was like, you know, 30 million Americans watched the Beatles screaming into their microphones and shaking their hair, you know. And they didn't play, you know, a big band instruments. They had electric guitars. So all of this was, it was like, you know, you live your life in a certain way. And you think, this is how it has to be, right? This is how it has to be. And everybody does this. You know, people create a kind of collective dream. It's a collective dream. And anybody who gets out of the dream can be a target of retaliation. It's definitely true. So generally people live... They learn to accept the collective dream as their reality. You know, and that's certainly how we were living in the United States. And the way we were living was, in some ways, totally crazy, you know. I mean, I do remember in 1963, I was just a little boy, but we had something called the Cuban Missile Crisis. The Russians put missiles in Cuba, And we were so upset that the Russians put missiles in Cuba that we were almost ready to go to war with them. They would have drills at school where we would get down on the ground and cover our heads in case of nuclear attack, right. Which is absurd.
Right.
So, you know, but nobody I know questioned any of this. People built bomb shelters in their houses. So Life magazine had a story about how all these Americans were planning for nuclear war. So, and it actually had, like, you could get plans for your own nuclear bomb shelter in your own home. Now look, nobody is going to survive in one of these shelters, right? But this was part of the culture. So people actually, there were stories in local newspapers about Jim Smith builds bomb shelter, and it showed him in the shelter with his kids and his, you know, they're all smiling and there's a naked light bulb hanging down. Right. So this was the world we grew up in. You know, everybody was very patriotic, you know. At school we had to cover our hearts with our hand and recite the Pledge of Allegiance. And, you know, when the Beatles came, it was just so amazing. They were like strange visitors from another planet, you know, from another dimension. And you suddenly realized it doesn't have to be this way. It doesn't have to be this way. They made a movie. They had a movie called Help. This was their and I remember seeing it as a little kid and just thinking it was hilarious. And in the movie, the Beatles behave in a way that's not very rational. You know, so they're very spontaneous and they do things just on the spur of the moment. And what they do is a little crazy, little nutty, and people around them either are nonplussed. They're either thrown off balance by their craziness, or they sort of get into the craziness, right? So the message of the movie is, you know, join the craziness, see? And all of this was incredibly, you know, people didn't sit down and analyze the movie, but they absolutely, you know, the movie was a huge seller. You know, it just, huge numbers of people saw Help. And there was a soundtrack, and you had to buy the soundtrack, right? And I remember my cousin, who used to live in Montclair, would just play, when I would visit, a couple times a year, we'd go and visit him, and, you know, he'd just lie on the ground and listen to the Beatles play their albums. You know, he'd play Beatles albums over and over again. He would just probably play those movies in his head, you know. It felt so liberating to realize we don't have to do things this way. So I think the Beatles were a tremendously positive influence on our culture. I really do think they shook things up in a wonderful way, and I think in some ways, you know, Zen does something very similar. You know, if you start practicing Zen and you sit on the cushion until you can enter samadhi, that's a really positive experience. But it's only like scratching the surface, because, you know, once you've entered samadhi, you have laid the foundation for a deeper transformation of your life if you wish to pursue it. You know, I think it's kind of a shame that mindfulness has become so popular in our culture, because mindfulness is really used so often as a way of making our reality, our familiar reality, more tolerable, you know. So, there are corporations. Johnson & Johnson runs mindfulness classes for its employees, and I'm not criticizing Johnson & Johnson, but, you know, it's not like when the Beatles came. You know, Johnson & Johnson didn't play Beatles music, because Beatles music sort of shook things up. You know, Johnson & Johnson are not using Vipassana to shake things up. They're using Vipassana to calm things down. They don't want people to experience life in new ways. They want them to come in an hour earlier for work. See? Now, this doesn't make them evil. You know, they're not like Mr. Burns in The Simpsons or something like that. But it's very important for people to wake up to the fact that the world they live in is an artificial world. And people call the world we live in reality. You know, so, you know, if I had said in the 1960s, you know, maybe it's not so important to wear a white shirt to work. Maybe I could wear a blue shirt. You know, people would look at you and say, get with reality, you know. The reality was, wear a white shirt to work, wear black slacks, you know, wear a tie. If you didn't come in with a tie, people thought maybe you had a problem, right? Starting Zen practice and learning how to enter samadhi is very, very important. And being able to have a blue sky mind, very important. But the deeper aspects of Zen are more far-reaching than that, right? You know, Dalai Lama was. I was reading something the other day by the Dalai Lama, and I'm rereading, I should say. It was an interview with the Dalai Lama from many years ago. And a Western reporter, said to the Dalai Lama, "Well, what's this all about, this meditation?" And the Dalai Lama didn't say it's about calming down in stressful times, although it is. He didn't say it's about feeling better when you're down, although it is. The Dalai Lama said it's about the total transformation of the human being. And the reporters moved on to the next question. He didn't ask what that meant. I thought that was so amazing. It's like, wow, aren't you going to ask him what that means? But I think that Zen practice can be used just to feel better when you're down, and those are very positive, and to feel less stressed, and to be better at your job. I myself have benefited in my job enormously from my Zen practice. It's definitely the case that if I'm very stressed out and I come here on a Wednesday night and I sit, I go home, and the next day I feel so much better at work. So it does help me to do my job, and I'm not criticizing that. But there's something bigger going on with all of this, right? You know, we think we're living in reality, and it's just a collective dream. And every once in a while, something like the Beatles happens in a society, and it just blows a hole open, and people realize there's all these possibilities that we didn't know existed. So many, all we know is we don't know what they are right now. Zen and Buddhism in general have that characteristic. You know, it's really trying to open things up. If you think about it, you know, if you read Zen literature and you read about Zen masters, you know, in the classical Chinese literature, they often behave like the Beatles. You know, Joshu puts sandals on his head. And if you read anecdotes about great Zen masters, they're often doing things that are a little strange, like Han Shan and Shirde. You know, doing things a little crazy. Shirde would run around town and make mischief, right? And one time, Han Shan and Shirde were invited to a vegetarian banquet. And Shirde turned over the table. That was probably going a little too far. Please don't do that if somebody invites you to a vegetarian banquet. But, you know, he was trying to shake things up, you know, like the Beatles. A little bit crazy, you know, a little bit wacky, right? Very important. So Zen definitely has this style of shaking things up, too. And the goal of Zen practice is to help people realize that your life is all scripted for you right now. It's been scripted in a way, you know, even though our lives feel very uncertain because our society doesn't support us, our lives are rather scripted, you know, rather scripted. So, you know, it's true when we feel uncertain at certain moments in our life, you know, but You know, it's not pleasant to be without a script. So, you know, when I got out of college, I didn't know what I wanted to do. So I managed a restaurant, and after doing that for a year, I realized I did not want to do that. It was so hard. And I had a couple other jobs before I went back to graduate school. When I went to graduate school, suddenly I had like this script, right? So I'll be a graduate student, I'll learn these things, I can be a professor, it's all clear to me, right? But then when I got my PhD, there were very few jobs in my field, and for a couple of years I was teaching part-time here and there. And again, I just wanted a script, give me a script, right? So I finally got a job here at Rutgers, and it was like, oh, finally a script. So, you know, it's definitely true that we like to have a script. But there's more to life than the script. And if you just practice Zen to stay in the script, that's okay. There's nothing wrong with that. But there's a bigger possibility. You know, every once in a while, something happens that shakes things up. Now it's difficult to keep that openness alive, you know, actually. So you know, it's funny. We all used to have to wear to school like a white shirt or a blue shirt and black Farrah slacks. Almost everybody on the bus, when we would go to school, all the boys would dress like that. And sneakers or loafers or something. That was a sort of like an unofficial uniform for boys in school. Some boys would wear blue jeans, sort of nicely pressed blue jeans. But that wasn't really very common when I was a kid. And then the Beatles came, and they wore tight pants with that stopped at the ankle and pointy shoes. And so, you know, there was like an explosion, and everybody was excited, and there were all these new possibilities. And then one day I was going to school, and I noticed all these kids had pants that stopped at their ankles and pointy shoes, see? And pretty soon, lots of kids had haircuts like the Beatles. I remember one of my friends in school was a guy named Tommy Pugh, P-U-G-H. You, that poor guy, you can imagine the jokes. Tommy Pugh, and he was the nicest guy, and he had a Beatles haircut, and it made up for his name, right? It was just, they forgot about his name. He was the coolest guy in school for a while, you know. And another one of my friends, Jeff Morgan, he also got the Beatles cut, and it was like his status improved instantly. And I told my mother I had very curly hair, you know, a little bit wiry. So I told my mother I want a Beatles cut, and it was like, that's never going to work, right? You know. So I never got a Beatles cut, and I begged her, please, you know, there must be some way to make this work. And then the Beatles, for a while, they had a certain kind of, I remember they were wearing a certain kind of shirt. There was like a shirt that you had to have. And I remember begging my mother for that shirt, you know, please. So it's interesting, right? I mean, the Beatles came and they shook everything up and they created an explosion. And there was this possibility. And then, you know, pretty soon, instead of wearing a white shirt and slacks, everybody was wearing a Beatles shirt and a different kind of pants to school with pointy shoes, right? So it's hard to keep that openness open. It's not an illusion. That openness is not an illusion. It's like a glimpse of reality. People woke up, and many good things happened during that period. You know, people explored meditation. One of the reasons that you know, Buddhism became very big at that time, the Beatles were interested in Maharishi Mahesh and his teachings, and there were meditation. People were building ashram in the United States, and many of the founders of the big Zen centers in the United States came at this time, and there was great openness to this. And if it hadn't been for the Beatles and what went on culturally at that time, none of this would have happened. It was just that people realized, you know, life doesn't have to be this way, the way we think it has to be. And there was this great explosion of energy, and it produced much positive change. I think it's probably the case that we need a dose of that right now. When I look at our society, I think people feel very much sort of like there's no alternative to where we are. And so I don't think the Beatles are coming back, but I definitely think we all need to work hard on keeping our reality open and not falling into the trap of thinking the so-called reality is the way it has to be. You know, it's harder than we think, though. You know, you can get a Beatles haircut, you can get Beatles pants, but in a way, you're already starting to close the world down again. See? You're actually, you know, when I went to college, basically, there was a college uniform that everybody wore. You had to have blue jeans. You had to have, like, women wore like peasant blouses, which are these beautiful blouses with baggy sleeves. A lot of girls wore peasant blouses. So if you went into a classroom, all you saw were guys with long hair, bell-bottom blue jeans, and the women had bell-bottoms and they had peasant blouses, or they wore peasant skirts, right, with boots. So, you know, you could say, well, everybody was back in a system again. Everybody, this was how you had to dress. If I had come into my college classes with a polyester Farrah slacks and a white shirt, people would have looked at me like I had dropped out of the sky from Mars, right? So we create, it's like there's an opening, and then we close it up gradually. And so, you know, it's difficult for cultures to keep that openness. And it's difficult for us as individuals to keep that openness. You know, life is such a routine, right? You know, most of us, it's just trying to get through the day. You get up, you have to get to your job, you have to take a shower and brush your teeth. If you meditate in the morning, you have to get up and meditate. You get to work, and then you do your stuff, and then you come home, and maybe you have kids to take care of. You know, by the time it's 9 o'clock, it's like my brother-in-law and my sister have two kids. They're now 12 and 10. But I noticed on my brother-in-law's Facebook page, he said something like, "I'm born to be wild until 9 o'clock." And then that means he's exhausted and he goes to bed. So, you know, that's definitely true for a lot of people. But as cultures, it's hard to keep a culture open. And we're in a period right now culturally where we're getting very, very closed up, right? There's a lot of pressure on people to fall into line, unfortunately. And it's possible because things look rather like we're everything is getting locked down and all the doors are getting locked and all the windows are getting closed, it's possible to feel suffocated or trapped. But we have, especially those of us who practice Zen, we have a secret weapon. You know, Zen practice is all about opening up your world again and again. You know, we do, in our tradition, we do koan training. And you know, what koans do is it gives you a contradiction. And you can't solve the contradiction with, you can't solve the contradiction with the tools you bring to the koan, see. You know, you have to develop a whole new way of seeing in order to resolve the koan. You have to develop a whole new way of seeing to answer the koan. So every time you're working with a koan, it's like you have to step outside your familiar way of seeing things and really go through a kind of crisis period. And then suddenly, when you come back to the koan, it seems self-evident what the answer should be. Or at least, you give me the answer, and I say that's the right answer. And you might not feel you know why. But unconsciously, you've gone through a process of like re-patterning or restructuring your experiential world, you know? So, you know, koans force us to go through this process, force us to go to have the Beatles visit us again and again. And if you aren't able to respond to the koan, it's because you're holding on too tightly to your familiar way of seeing things. So the way of Zen is really to go through this process of having the Beatles arrive, and then having the Rolling Stones arrive, and then having the living, having the Grateful Dead arrive, and it keeps shaking you up. Uman held out his staff and said to the assembled monks, "This staff has transformed itself into a dragon and swallowed up the universe. Where are the mountains, the rivers, and the great world?" He's really asking you, can you see this in a new way? Can you, this, you know, we all know what a staff is, you know, we use it to walk. And it's that matter of factness that shows we aren't awake. So he's holding up the staff and he's saying, "Can you know this staff can turn into a dragon? You can see the world in a totally new way if you're in deep samadhi and you enter blue sky mind and you experience the staff." It's just like calling Mu. You know, anybody can call Mu, but can you call Mu freely and spontaneously in a totally new way that you yourself don't understand right now? And the answer is yes. You know, yes. We really trap ourselves because we don't believe that we have this amazing power. But, in his introduction, Engo says, Buddhas and sentient beings are not by nature different. What they have in common is the ability to enter blue sky mind and then look at the world and see it in a constantly new way. Buddhas and sentient beings are not by nature different. Mountains, rivers, and your own self are all just the same. Why should they be separate and constitute two worlds? Even if you are well versed in Zen koans and know how to deal with them, if you stop there, everything is spoiled. If you do not stop, the whole world will be dissolved with not a particle of it left behind. Another way to put it is, if you do not stop, your life will be totally transformed, with not a particle of the old life left behind. Now tell me, what does it mean to be well-versed in koans? Uman held out a staff and said to the assembled monks, "This staff has transformed itself into a dragon and swallowed up the universe. Can you enter Mushin? Can you enter blue sky mind? Can you see the staff in a new way?" Cetra's verse. "The staff has swallowed the universe. The staff has swallowed up your universe. Don't say peach blossoms float on the waters. The fish that gets its tail singed may fail to grasp the mist and clouds. The ones that lie with gills exposed need not lose heart." This is so important, you know. In we think, especially right now, right? I mean, this has been a bad week if you believe in democracy. And we think, right, that we're trapped. But we are never trapped. We are never trapped. You know, we are never trapped. Even if you are tied up in a chair, you are not powerless. You are not powerless. You just think you're powerless. As soon as you stop thinking that you're powerless, you can begin to change things. So we feel like we're a fish lying on the shore with its gills exposed, trying to gasp at the air. But that is our illusion. We have the power to change our staff into dragons. Need not lose heart. My verse is done, but do you really hear me? Only be carefree. Stand on wavering. Why so bewildered? 72 blows are not enough. I want to give you 150.